Seated, everyone. Okay, this is the time set for oral argument in the case of Lee versus State of Nevada. And before we get underway, I want to welcome the Michael Douglas Pre-Law Foundation students who are here. We are so glad to have you. And I've told the lawyers that you'd be listening to the oral argument today. The appellate court process is probably a little foreign to students because you think of the law as people examining witnesses and cross-examining them and juries deliberating and all the rest of it. The appellate process, that is over. They're bringing to us an appeal from a determined case from the trial court. There are no live witnesses. It's all oral argument from the lawyers about alleged errors that occurred, either constitutional or statutory or evidentiary, in the district court. And they bring it to us and they ask us to review whether or not they should get a new trial based on the errors that they allege occurred. And each side is represented and they present their arguments. I practiced for many years before I became a justice on the court, and it always struck me as sort of a pyramid where you finally are distilled to 15 minutes per side of oral argument of a case that may have lasted years, getting it to trial. And sometimes there's a reversal and a new trial, so it can truly go on for a very long time, and yet it's distilled to a very short session, and that's what you're here for today. Before we get underway, but on the record, I want to ask each of the lawyers to briefly do what is really counterintuitive to lawyers, and that's turn their back to us on the bench and introduce themselves to all of you and give them a brief overview of your professional background and maybe a simple summary of the case, no more than a minute or two, and then we'll get underway with the arguments. But I'm going to do the brief intro first. So the appellant will speak first, then you, and then we'll get underway with the proper arguments, the more formal arguments, and the 17 minutes aside. Is that clear to everyone? And let me, before we do get all the way underway, my colleague on my left is Justice Patricia Lee, and on my right is Justice Alicia Kadish. And here's an interesting fact note that when I joined the court in 2009, I was the fifth woman to serve on the Nevada Supreme Court. And today we have five women on the Nevada Supreme Court, a five-woman majority out of seven. So, and just 2 years ago, I think it was, that Justice Kadish and I were on the first, maybe 3 years ago, all-woman panel of three. So with that, the floor is yours. Thank you.
My name is Michael McAvoy, and I'm the counsel for the appellate. Case here is an appeal of a court. We are alleging process violation. Numerous errors that occurred in the trial. You're going to hear a lot about the case here coming up soon. My background, it's all the legal background. My background is I have my own practice. I have a general practice, one of the in-house practices. For those of you thinking about becoming a lawyer, it's a very stressful job. You're burned out. It's hard, for a lot of people like Mr. G or I, I'm like, myself, I went to law school, I went to public defender, stuff like that. Those jobs are few and far between. Any of you, if you do decide to go to law school, you're going to have litigation or whatever. Taking on pro bono work, I am here on a pro bono basis. There is nothing more enjoyable than standing. I feel like the one here today, free of the corrupting influence of money. Even if I know Mr. Giordani can testify, the prosecutor, and he believes in the job, and so I will let him continue.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, good morning, everyone. My name is John Giordani. I've been with the DA's office for about 13 years now. homicide team now. I've been with the homicide team about 4 years. McAvoy and Maya is absolutely correct. I absolutely agree. Also, in what they do, there's holes on both sides. Both sides are necessary for the system to have. I'm a product of the Clark County School District. I have an elementary school, middle school, high school, CSN, UNLV, and then William S. Boyd School of Law. So all of you local students, keep pushing away. We'll let them hear someday. I'm not going to get into the facts of the case. Obviously, that's your argument. It's a child homicide. It is a very dark subject matter, and we will be talking about it quite a bit, so I apologize in advance for this. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you both so much. You may begin. And we have 17 minutes per side with the 2 minute hiatus.
Do you want me to introduce myself again, or?
No, you may start your formal argument now. You get 2 minutes without interruption from us, and then you need to tell me how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If there was ever a case that warranted reversal for cumulative error, it is this case. The district court itself described this case as a comedy of errors. It is better described as a tragedy of due process. Pre-trial, the court disclosed sealed ex parte defense trial strategy. On day one, the court arbitrarily held the ordered evidentiary hearing without notice, did not resolve the Sixth Amendment issues, and failed to enter evidence into the record. Day three, the court arbitrarily insisted on holding a hearing on the motion to dismiss without notice, time to prepare, or a response from the state. Day four, the defense was forced to change its trial strategy after the state's misrepresentation that Gavin expanded the injury window to 48 hours. Day five, the court arbitrarily refused to continue trial to permit evidence fault review. The court arbitrarily refused to continue trial upon discovery of the June 2011 interview, video, evidence log, and the other undisclosed evidence in the vault, and allowed testimony to begin before the defense had an opportunity to review the evidence. Day six, the court denied the defense continuance to try and enhance the audio of the interview. Gavin told the state the injury window was 72 hours, not 48 hours as the state had represented. The court did not continue trial when informed that the interview transcript could not be produced in 48 hours. Day seven, the court allowed Brad Mosher to testify prior to the defense having the transcript. Day eight, the defense expert had to testify out of order because of the unavailability of the transcript. The court allowed Meredith Mosher's testimony to be read into the record despite its non-disclosure in the first trial. Day nine, the court allowed the state to enter an incomplete unofficial interview transcript with 454 unintelligible notations. Day 10, the state tried to enter the same faulty jury instruction that resulted in reversal the last time twice. The court arbitrarily denied continuance to allow development of closing arguments. The state shifted the burden of proof to the defense. The jurors discussed the penalty phase prior to guilt. Post-trial, the court denied mistrial despite the severe prejudice caused by these errors, which individually and cumulatively denied Michael Lee a fair trial. Michael's conviction must be overturned because the state acted in bad faith when it intentionally misrepresented Gavin's expansion of the possible injury window to 72 hours and knowingly withheld the June 2011 interview video. The state responds to the Brady issues by arguing that the evidence was ultimately disclosed in trial. Under Nevada law, there is one remedy for a discovery violation when the state acts in bad faith, a mistrial under Langford.
Counsel, wasn't there a continuance granted to adjust to the change of the timelines to give you guys an opportunity to...
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. They were granted a continuance for the 48-hour timeline. It is because of the failure to disclose the 72-hour timeline, which is what materially affected the case, increasing the number of individuals who could have caused the injury from two, which was critical to the state's position in trial, to six. It also included numerous accidents that the child was known to have occurred within the injury window, including the curtain rod injury, the injury when the toy car flipped over.
Counsel, it's not unusual. Let's assume for a moment that the witness testified to a 72-hour window. Then it's not unusual that a witness testifies a little differently at a trial than we expect them to testify, or maybe even than a disclosure has indicated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to start over with a new trial. It means, you know, you do the normal trial tactics to address any difference in their testimony.
That's a great question. Thank you for it. That is correct. A regular witness may change their testimony here and there, but this particular witness was a state expert. We have rules for disclosure of state expert testimony prior to trial because defense counsel is not scientific experts. Defense counsel
examine the expert and impeach that expert on that discrepancy?
Thank you for the question. That is a good point. But the problem here is that defense counsel is not an expert themselves. They are not experts in estimating the injury window. It is why for the Brady violation with regards to the Gavin testimony, under federal law and Nevada law, the issue is whether or not it was disclosed in time for use at trial. The defense counsel could not process what it meant because it was scientific expert testimony, siderophages, slides. These things needed to be produced in time so that the defense could get its own expert. And I would note,
didn't the defense have its own expert at the first trial? So didn't they have years of extra time by the second trial to do so if they wanted to?
Thank you, and that is a great point. The defense absolutely did have that expert at the first trial, and that is extremely important because when this court affirmed that conviction, it took Dr. Gavin's testimony about the 24-hour period over that testimony. When on retrial, instead of focusing on that, given that it was likely that any reviewing court would rely on the 24-hour period anyway, the defense counsel chose a different trial strategy. However, had it been disclosed, they would have known that they needed to call that same expert, and there would have been two experts, one from the state and one from the defense, that the 72-hour injury period was the accurate injury period, that Michael Lee and Erica Foster were not the only two individuals who could have caused the injury, and that was the state's entire case.
But Dr. Gavin's opinion, even at this trial, was her best conclusion was that it was actually 24 hours, but potentially up to 48 hours. That was her opinion, correct?
No. Her opinion outside the presence of the jury was that it was up to 72 hours because of the siderophages, and the majority of the medical literature says that you do not see those except for up to 48 to 72 hours, which is exactly what the prior expert had testified to. And if two experts had testified to that, both of them would have had to, the defense would have known that they needed to cross-examine her on that, and they would have been able to flesh out this issue and the fact that
examine her in front of the jury after that, outside the presence?
They were able to do so, but again, it was not disclosed with sufficient time for them to process it. They did not have sufficient time to call their own expert. They did not have sufficient time to, and in the context of the entire case, this is a situation where something new, some change happened every single day. And so continuances, yes, there was a continuance for the 48 hours, but there was numerous other continuances that were requested that were denied. Denial of a continuance is a violation of the right to fair trial if it's based on the court's unreasoned and arbitrary need for expediency. Here, the court's reasoning for denying continuances to finish voir dire, to hold sufficient evidentiary hearings, to to review the new evidence, to enhance the audio of the June 2011 interview, to ensure the video could be adequately transcribed for use at trial, to prepare closing arguments, took no consideration of the prejudice that it caused to the defense to try the case, and appears to be based only on the mild inconvenience a continuance would have caused the jury. The court's unreasoned and arbitrary need for expedience caused the defense to have to investigate, prepare for, and try the case all at the same time, which violates basic considerations of fair play and due process, as this court held in Rudin v. State, especially considering this individual was being charged with murder.
Counsel, is there anything in the record about why nobody in the first 11 years of this case went to the evidence vault to see what was there?
There is nothing on that. Again,
is it true that there is
no evidence that neither side did that, but it's the state's duty to discover evidence that is available to the state, and constructive knowledge is applied to them when it's known to exist by the officers. The evidence in this case is absolutely clear. The affidavit of the lead investigator, Officer Collins, the arrest warrant affidavit, stated expressly that the June 2011 interview was recorded to CD, sent out for transcription.
He testified in the first trial that it had been recorded, but that the recording had been lost.
That he testified that it was overwritten.
Okay, it was unavailable.
Could not be down.
He testified to that in the first trial.
He testified that it was overwritten before it could be downloaded. He is the one who logged it into evidence. The state's argument that new technology over time made it accessible has no basis in the record. The testimony of Collins was that it was overwritten and couldn't be downloaded.
Right.
Based on what he was told by a secretary, when he's the one who logged the CD into evidence. His email to the DA said it was overwritten and was not copied to a CD.
Right.
The testimony at both trials supported that. There is no liberal interpretation of those facts that could make any reasonable person come to the conclusion that the overwritten story was anything
other
than a
fabrication.
So
what would have been different if trial counsel, defense trial counsel, had that recording sooner, which is obviously what should have happened?
Yes. If defense trial counsel had the recording sooner, they could have, like they requested, given it to an investigator to try and enhance the video so that a usable transcript could have then been produced.
Do we have anything about whether, in fact, that would have helped? And, what would it have accomplished?
What it would have accomplished is there would not have been 454 unintelligible responses. This court's decision in Dorado v. State was clear that when a transcript has numerous unintelligible responses, it makes it unusable by the state for cross-examination. And in this case, the state itself capitalized on the unintelligibles itself, asking Erica Foster to testify about what she recalled about one of the unintelligibles, which could not be rebutted by Michael Lee because it was not clear in the transcript and they couldn't hear it in the audio because they were not given an opportunity to enhance it prior to sending it out for transcription.
But how do we know that enhancement was possible? I mean, there can be things that are unintelligible because someone is not speaking clearly and the quality of the recording just doesn't make it clear what they're saying. We can't necessarily change those facts and circumstances of the interview and the recording.
Much of the discussion about the recording also indicated that the transcriber could not hear who was saying what in the interview, which if it had been enhanced, the defense would have at least had an opportunity to get a better usable transcript. In addition to that, the transcript that was actually produced was only a partial transcript. It was not a full transcript or a certified one. I am going to
reserve
my thought. Sorry.
Thanks, counsel. Okay.
May it please the court, and thank you for your time hearing me out today. Erica Foster began dating Michael Lee in October of 2010. What she didn't know at the time was that Michael had just been released from prison for 22 violent felony convictions and that he would take the life of her child just 6 months later. This case is personal to me. It's hard to say that, but it is. This case has been tried twice by myself. Mr. McAvoy Amaya was not present, and it spanned the entirety of my career. Never have I believed in a conviction more than this one. Michael Lee received a fair trial the second time. There is no doubt about it. I will tell the court, the timeline in this case couldn't be more clear. As you all know, and as I know as a prosecutor of homicides and particularly child homicides, what these come down to is typically a timeline. A timeline of who had custody, care, and control of the child at the time the injuries were inflicted. Most child abusers do not commit child abuse in front of other people. And so we have to look at the evidence and figure out who had control of the kid, who could have authored the injuries. Here, the timeline was clear as day. Thank God Brody's family loved him. They took care of him. They took photos of him. They took him to the pediatrician. Erica Foster took him 11 times in the last year of his life. As recently as 5 days before he was murdered, because she was concerned about his pink eye. She cared about this child. The doctor was a mandatory reporter 5 days before his death. He didn't observe any injuries. That kid was fine 5 days before his death. 3 days before his death, the family took him out to breakfast and snapped a photo of Brody, eating pancakes and drinking syrup. He was fine. He was asymptomatic. He didn't have his duodenum transected for sure 3 days prior. There were only two people who had custody and control of him in the last 72 hours. So the big deal about the 72 hours is actually not one at all. Monday through Wednesday, Erica Foster and Michael Lee. That is it. And then the jury had to make a call. Erica sat through 9 hours, I think, of cross-examination. It was difficult. She cried. She was torn apart in front of this jury. And they looked at her and they said, no chance this woman killed her kid. Absolutely no chance, leaving one person and one person alone, and that's Michael Lee. I will, with respect to my colleagues, say that the timeline in this case, as pled in the briefs, is distorted. It's either misinterpreted or it's distorted. So I would urge this court, before overturning this and putting that family through this for a third time, please review the record itself. Please do not rely on the statements
counsel,
made.
Can you address the defendant's counsel regarding the late disclosure of this CD recording, which Detective Collins notes, previously he testified that a recording of the interview no longer existed when it did. And then the evidence log itself wasn't produced until the 11th day of trial. So what's going on with these late disclosures, and how does that not cause reversible prejudice to the defendant?
Absolutely, Justice Lee. And I will tell you that there is one error in this case, but it does not arise to a reversible error, and that is a statutory late disclosure. I take full responsibility for that. I should have sent Detective Collins to that evidence vault to search it from top to bottom a long time ago. I didn't. Everyone believed this thing did not exist, or if it did exist, it didn't work. We disclosed the June 15th interviews of Erica Foster, the June 20th, 24th, several other interviews. This one just... no one believed it existed. Had we known, obviously, we wouldn't be here today. I will tell you that any suggestion that this is Brady violation is a bit outlandish and not in line with this court's law. This is a statutory issue that does not arise to reversible error. The two main concerns this court has is whether the defense was prejudiced, right, or whether the court took sufficient steps to ameliorate the harm. I want to briefly address the bad faith suggestion because it's personally offensive to me. Defense counsel at trial, you know, when you do a trial with attorneys, you kind of get to know one another. You're in the trenches together and you get a feel for one another. And they said on the record it was not intentional. So for this to second guess that at this point, it's a bit personally offensive. I want to note also that we did not receive a tactical advantage by this late disclosure. Everyone got it at the same time. Ms. Bernstein and I drove down to the evidence vault after court one day and got to look at it the exact same time. The big note, and Justice Kadish asked a great question, was what would have been different? Absolutely nothing. You'll notice that the appellant's briefs do not address the fact that they had for over a decade a 7-page detailed summary of this statement. There is nothing materially different from what they've had all along to what they got day two of trial at the same time we got. And it's important to note with the bad faith suggestion that disc did have a can't upload written right across the envelope. Detective Collins thought it, I don't even know if he understands the difference between download and upload, but Detective Collins was not in bad faith trying to hide something. He went out after, I think it was the second night of trial, got dressed, he was retired, he went to the vault, he searched, he found it, and he's the one that told us about it. There is no bad faith there. I will also note that...
Did the prosecution exploit unintelligible portions of that recording to suggest that something different was said than what was actually said?
Absolutely not, and that this is common sense. This woman had just lost her two-year-old. She woke up to his cold, dead body laying next to her. She was unintelligible in a lot of that, as Justice Kadish suggested. She was crying. She was wailing. She was unintelligible. No continuance would have done anything different or changed anything in this case. And I will note that a continuance was offered to the defense. I said it myself. I said, look, this is a shock to everybody. If we need to continue this, let's do it. We don't need to try Michael Lee for a third time. Let's get this done. They strategically declined that. They cannot complain on appeal now for on a remedy that they didn't want. I will also note there was absolutely zero prejudice. The district court, who was in the best position to analyze the impact that this June 17th statement had, actually said in her post-conviction findings of fact, it was not material. It had very minimal impeachment value, not to mention the defense had the substance of that statement for over a decade in that seven-page summary, which goes back to the bad faith or good faith analysis of Detective Collins. He doesn't normally do a single-space seven-page summary of a statement. He thought it was overwritten, so he did his best to incorporate the notes and the reports into the record so everyone had it. Everyone knew what Erica Foster said on June 17th. There was no question about that.
You alluded to this being a statutory issue and not a Brady issue. Is that because of it was late disclosed and you're saying Brady doesn't apply to late disclosures, or is it for some other reason that you're articulating this that way?
Justice Pickering, what I mean by that is we clearly had a duty statutorily to turn over any recorded statement, no doubt. Brady does not reach as far as I think appellate wants it to. Now, I understand that there are questions that the court must analyze in the context of Brady, but it does not reach as far as they are suggesting. This was a late disclosure.
Okay, but you're not arguing that categorically Brady would not apply to a late disclosure?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, just.
Thank you.
So then why are you saying it's not Brady? Because
the court did everything they could to ameliorate the harm, and because the defense was not prejudiced in any way whatsoever.
Could you talk a little bit about the inadvertent disclosure of the trial strategy of the defendant?
Absolutely. Never before have I been placed under oath by a trial judge and let my colleague from across the aisle cross-examine me. It was a bit uncomfortable. I will say that, but I will tell you that there has never been any alternative theory in this case that is plausible. Now, there was kind of an argument that it could have been accidental, but based on the medical testimony and the photos of Brody post-death, this was not an accidental injury. So there was one possible defense in this case, and that's Michael didn't do it, Erica Foster did it, or the state didn't meet the burden of proof that Michael didn't do it. Whatever was in that, I still don't know to this day, but the trial court was able to look at it, the sealed document. What the trial court said without revealing whatever was in it is that I'm paraphrasing, there's nothing in there that's a surprise to anybody. So whether it was sent to my office and 17 different secretaries who never click on the links or may have clicked on the link, we didn't know what was in there, but from what I can gather through the fine print of the court's words is whatever was in there didn't affect anything. And I want to, talk about Dr. Gavin's situation. Gavin. So this is important. You cannot time death ever precisely unless the death is caught on camera or witnessed by someone. And so every trial dealing with a time of death by a coroner, it's an inexact science. What you must do is not look at the medical testimony in a vacuum. You have to look at the context around the child's life, his behavior, his actions, his demeanor, his appetite. These are the types of things that can tell you when this deadly, lethal injury was inflicted upon him. Because that little two-year-old boy is not drinking syrup after his duodenum is completely transected.
Agree that the timeline here is critical, right? Because
absolutely,
who had access to the child during those hours? I mean, it's important. And there was a change in testimony in terms of the window of time that this child could have expired, correct?
The timeline is absolutely important, but it's not just a timeline provided by Dr. Gavin. It's the context around it. It's the appetite, the photographs that we had of the child, et cetera. Now, I will tell you this. The fact that there is a suggestion that we violated Brady with this disclosure is outlandish. Okay. We were told the night before, Dr. Gavin is very experienced. I've had her in dozens and dozens of cases. She went back after, the night before she was going to testify, she reviewed her slides. She said, hey, I'm seeing a few more siderophages and macrophages in these slides than I noticed in the first trial. We said, great, thanks a lot. And also, okay, we need to disclose this to the defense. That's the right thing to do. So we sent them a text, or it was a text or an email, 8:45 or 9 o'clock that night. We then walked in the next morning. We made our record. Dr. Gavin has told us this. I said, we certainly don't want to have to do this trial a third time. We want Mr. Lee to have a fair trial. We want the defense to be effective. I think they've been effective so far and would continue to be. We'll submit to the court on what you want to do about this. And that's at 8 Appellate's Appendix 1897. Court turned to the defense. Ms. Miller, what remedy are you requesting at this point in time? And they wanted to consult with their clients. We went off the record, came back on the record. They asked for a 24-hour continuance. The court said, I'll do you one better, and gave them the entire weekend, gave them a three-day continuance. That's at Volume 8, pages 1899. We then come back on Monday. We made a record of the continuance since Thursday. And I said, just want to make it abundantly clear before we swear in this jury that defense feels comfortable now, that they feel comfortable going forward, that they feel they can be effective. Ms. Miller responded, we can be effective. We're prepared, Your Honor. And we went on.
The scientific evidence has been available for 11 years, has it not?
Absolutely. And it really didn't change. So Dr. Gavin stuck with, as Justice Kagan suggested, she stuck with her original thing, which was, it's around 24 hours. I'm never going to give you an exact number. Siderophages and macrophages can appear 48 to 72 hours. But again, he's not just convicted based on Dr. Gavin's testimony.
But the slides that showed that were the same slides that were intact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She was going back.
So another expert who looked at them could have seen the same thing.
Yeah, and I believe they did. In the first trial, the defense expert did see that. So the suggestion that something would have changed had they wanted a continuance, they could have gotten an expert, it really doesn't matter because Dr. Gavin is testifying consistently with what any expert the defense had would have said.
Counsel, just out of curiosity, why such the wide gap between the first and the second trial? Because there's an 11-year gap?
Yes, it was... It was the appellate process. I'm not as familiar with your process as my process.
Okay. So it's our fault. I'm sorry. Never mind.
Well, if there was a direct appeal where the conviction was affirmed, and then there was subsequent habeas relief, which ultimately was granted.
You're absolutely right. And it was the jury instruction suggested that it may be a first degree murder if it's a negligent theory. We all know that's not the case.
Right.
And it was, that's right. It's counsel for trial and appeal should have caught that error and did not. And that's why it was reversed. And we had to go through that a second time.
Is there anything you wanted to say about the alleged jury misconduct or?
I will briefly address it. Yes.
I think we've covered everything else, but there was no mention of this. I know it was raised in the briefs.
Yes, Justice Leach. The jurors were canvassed and questioned to everyone's agreement. The court questioned these jurors, and I will say, I don't want to make any accusation that's unfounded, but the people who made this statement that they overheard something were the defendant's mom and his friend. So it was highly suspect to begin with. We then bring in the jurors like we always do if there's a question. We canvass. Court then says, state, you want any other jurors come in? No. Defense, any other jurors? No. We're good. We moved on. This is a non-issue, to be frank.
Thank you.
And I will just briefly address the judicial bias suggestion. I don't believe it really deserves a response, but I will say that adverse rulings do not amount to bias. And had anyone thought that Judge Bluth, who is a very well-respected jurist, as I'm sure you know, was biased in some way, they should have raised it. That suggestion was not made below and shouldn't be made now. The burden shifting, real quickly, the court gave a jury instruction, a cautionary instruction, which ameliorated any harm. I don't think the statement in and of itself was harmful to begin with. I think it's just a
reality. There's 4.7 billion or however many people on this earth, and there were only two people that had access to the kid during the operative time period. That's a fair statement, but out of an abundance of caution, the trial court instructed on the burden of proof. Briefly, I didn't address the suggestion that the trial court abused its discretion in the denials of the motion to continuance. The motion to disqualify DA hearing, that was your court told us we had to do that on Friday. Jury selection was set to start Monday. We had a jury in the hall. Court.
Can I ask in the last 40 seconds, the writ relief we granted to order the evidentiary hearing, which happened, when it was before us on writ, I think it was Senior Judge Barker that was showing, was he just filling in one day and had denied it and it was intended to be tried before Judge Bluth?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was sitting senior status.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's a suggestion that the court should have given a continuance for the closings. Absolutely, objectively false. Ms. Miller begged to close that night. We kept the staff till 6:30 that night. It was difficult. There's a suggestion we should have continued it on the motion to dismiss. That was rendered moot when we found the statement.
You may finish your thought.
With regard to the continued trial for a vault review, that actually was rendered moot because we actually did a vault review and everyone said they were ready to go. Thank you so much for hearing me out and letting me speak. This is a very important conviction to me, and I truly hope that you review the record when you affirm it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. You have 4 minutes and 29 seconds.
Yes, briefly, I want to discuss the application of Brady. As he just recognized, Brady does apply. When there is a non-disclosure, a late disclosure of evidence, the Brady analysis applies. The difference that occurs is that the court may then fashion a remedy other than dismissal. It's typically a mistrial, as this court noted in Thomas. It was also recently, after we filed our opening brief, also found in Collins as well.
But what are we to do when the defense counsel says we're good to go? We don't need any additional time. I mean, should the court not put any stock into that? Because the court offered more time, correct?
With regard to which issue?
The production of the CD, the interview.
With regard to the production of the CD, the court tried to fashion its own alternative remedy, which was ordering the transcript within 48 hours. And I acknowledge here today that if that had been achievable, then okay, that resolves the issue. And Fakisha Miller, the trial counsel, expressly conditioned the acceptance of the alternative remedy of I get the transcript in 48 hours, I have it in time for all the witnesses I need it for to testify. Had that been actually achievable, then there's no error here. But that didn't happen. It was not possible to record the transcript in 48
hours. Did the defense renew its motion to dismiss at that point?
It did not renew its motion to dismiss, but a waiver of the right to a fair trial cannot be waived. You have to knowingly relinquish it. And again, the court made its consistently said that it was insistent on proceeding with the trial. And
counsel did have the recording and had listened to it, even though they didn't have a transcript, right?
Correct. But all parties agreed that the audio could not be done. And resolution that the district court made.
What do you mean by that?
All the court, the state and the defense, when they were listening to it, they said that they couldn't make out certain things. They couldn't make out who was giving it.
Apparently, the person who did the transcript also couldn't.
And the resolution that the court fashioned for the issue of that was raised regarding seeing the what was being said inside the transcript was that they would get the transcript within 48 hours. The transcript
but let me pause you. Is there in this record a clean transcript?
No.
So you're asking us to speculate that had you had more time, a clean transcript would have been generated that would have been helpful. But that is not part of this record. You have the recording and you have the 48-hour transcript.
There is also not a full transcript that was produced either. There's a partial transcript that was a partial unofficial transcript that was not produced in 48 hours. It was produced on the day before trial ended. And under that circumstance, the remedy that was granted was not achievable and was not achieved. And because of that, the prejudice was not resolved. Two of the witnesses it was needed for finished their testimony before the transcript was even produced.
But where's the showing of prejudice, even to that last transcript that gets produced?
The showing of the transcript itself had numerous, it had content that was relevant for the cross-examination of Dr. Gavin. They discussed some of the injuries. Some of the responses were unintelligible. So but because of the amount of unintelligibles, it was ultimately, you know, under this court's decision in Dorado, you know, considered unusable for.
Was there anything different in that interview that we have because of the CD that's different than the detailed summary report that counsel had beforehand?
We will never know because of all the unintelligibles. As far as the existing
one. So as you stand here today, you don't know if there's any material difference between the notes in that report and what was actually said?
No. But again, with regards to the cumulative error and in regards to the non-disclosure of the video and the timeline of injury, I mean, substantial evidence isn't present in this case. The extension of the 72-hour timeline was critical to the case. On closing argument, they said out of 7.9 billion people, only two people could have done this, Erica and Michael, and it was six people that could have done it. And
within 72 hours?
Within 72 hours, yes. The Brad Mosier, Meredy Mosier, the aunt, and there was one other. It's escaping me right now, but there were six.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your arguments and the matter.